You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 230. If you're too rigid in your thinking, you may miss some wonderful opportunities for storytelling. Vince Gilligan.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft. It's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari.
Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com.
Well, guys, today we are going to go deep into the writer's room with our special guest, Nicole Levy. And Nicole has a brand new book called The Writer's Room Survival Guide. And Nicole and I get deep, deep, deep into the weeds on what it's like to be in a writer's room, how you get into a writer's room, how do you get a job, maintain a job, work your way up in the writer's room to different levels to eventually becoming, hopefully, the EP or executive producer, showrunner of a show, and so much more. So if you've ever been interested in what it's like being inside a network or streaming writer's room, this is the episode for you. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Nicole Levy.
I'd like to welcome to the show Nicole Levy. How are you doing, Nicole?
I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I'm excited to talk to you about your new book here, The Writer's Room Survival Guide. I've had many showrunners on the show, many TV writers on the show. I'm fascinated by the writer's room because I've only worked in the background of a writer's room, meaning in the office, seeing what the writers do when I was starting out as a office PA, right? And seeing, you know, talking to some of the writers and supervising writers. And what was that? What's it called when they, the cleanup guy, the guy comes in and kind of cleans up dialogue and what's his name? He wasn't in the room. Like, he was not even in the room. He was like outside. It's like doing more technical
like
stuff.
More like a consulting producer.
Type? Yeah, I think something like that. We're going to talk about the hierarchy as well, because there's way too many producers. I'm just going to throw that out there. Way, way too many producers. and I know there's a mystery behind that as well. But before we get started, how did you and why in God's green earth did you want to get into this insanity? Insanity that is the film industry.
Well, the why of it is really, I grew up in the middle of nowhere in this little town in the Mojave Desert called Ridgecrest. And it's like 110, 115 degrees every day in the summer. And so literally I spent summer vacation in front of the television because nobody was going outside till the sun was going down, and just was in love with it, was in love with movies and TV shows and all the things. And my parents were older parents, so I got to watch stuff that none of my friends got to watch because my parents were exhausted by the time I came along. So it was sort of like, yeah, whatever. We don't care that show's too grown up for her. And so I just loved it. And I originally thought my love of all of that meant I was going to be an actress, which now seems like an even crazier career choice, but at the time felt very reasonable.
Obviously.
And my parents were horrified, of course, but I was very independent spirit. And so I moved to LA and I went to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. Yep. And it was really while I was there and while I was performing all the time that I realized I was in love with storytelling, not necessarily with performing. Right. And so that's when I made the transition into writing and managed to get some decent day jobs and put myself through USC, and here I am.
So what was the when you got your first writing gig, like someone was paying you to type. I'm assuming not to put pen to paper because you're not that old. But to actually type, what was it like that first day walking into the room? Or did you start off as a writer's assistant or something else? But just the first time you were ever in that room, when you walked in for the first time, what was that like? Because I love letting other writers know the feeling of what the normal feelings are, and they're not crazy to feel them.
Absolutely. Now, by the way, I do have writer friends who still write pen to paper and then type it up. So it's age thing.
Listen, look, Eric Roth still uses DOS. So he has a machine that's DOS, and then he hands a floppy disk over to his assistant to translate it over to Final Draft. I'm not kidding you. So wow. He did Dune. Dune was written in that. So
to each their own.
To each their own.
So I got my first writing job really after about 10 years of actual effort trying to
overnight
success. Yeah. Because I had hefty student loans from USC, I could not afford to work as an assistant. It just was not realistic. I could not keep a roof over my head and somehow maintain those loans so that nobody came after me to pay them back. And so I did a whole bunch of day jobs, some of them industry connected, some of them not. And, you know, wrote. And finally, after 10 years and two network writing programs, I got an opportunity. I did the CBS Writers Mentoring Program and I did NBC's Writers on the Verge. And, got a showrunner meeting, and it was with Ken Sanzel, who was running Ironside that year. And I got a phone call at lunch saying, congratulations, you just got an offer to join a writer's room. And of course, it's literally just, you can't even believe it. Like, you've worked so hard for it. And the fact that someone's actually said, yes, I would like you to come to my writer's room, it's a little like, is that real? Is it real?
Who is this? Who is this? Bob, is that you?
Well, and the funny thing was, because I was at lunch, my phone was in my purse because Ken had said it would take a couple of days for him to decide. And so when I went to take my phone out after lunch, there were like 17 missed calls. And I was like, well, this is either really good or real bad. And wow. It was really good. And so, you know, that first day, basically what happens when you finally get a job as a staff writer, you will get a start email from the showrunner's assistant or the writer's assistant. And it's like, hey, welcome to X show. This is where our office is going to be. This is what time we start the first day. If you have any requests for special things, let me know. And like,
special things.
You just, you know, special things like, you know, do you need an ergonomic keyboard? Do you need whatever?
No green M&Ms. I can't eat green M&Ms. Start becoming a diva right off the bat. That works out great.
Probably not a great ask when you're a staff writer. Like, I was afraid to actually put my Clif Bars on the food menu in the writer's room. And one of my EPs came in and wrote them on. It was like, will you stop buying your own Clif Bars? Put them on the thing. it's a learning curve, definitely.
Let me ask you a question though. So you said 10 years of the hustle of struggling to try to get noticed. There's so many people listening right now who are writers who are in that boat right now, who are just writing and knocking on doors and nothing is happening for them. How did you get through a decade? Because generally, I always tell people have a 10-year plan. And if it hasn't panned out after 10 years, you might want to rethink situations, unless it's something that's still burning inside you. Because I forgot who it was. It was Taylor Sheridan. Taylor Sheridan was saying, he goes, I've never seen anyone pop after 10 or 15 years of butting their heads against the wall. He goes, it doesn't happen. He goes, after maybe 7 or 8 years, but after like 15 years, if it hasn't happened by then, the business will tell you, he said. The business will tell you, in his opinion, because he, by the way, he busted his ass as an actor for so long before he finally started to write, and he's doing okay now. he's doing all right now. But he goes, after 15 years, you really need to reevaluate what you're doing.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
It might be another aspect of the business, but it might not be what you want to do. So I have to ask that question to you, like, how did you keep going after all of this time?
Yeah, no, it's a really valid question. And one of the things I tell the writers that I mentor now is you have to know what you're willing to sacrifice and where your lines in the sand are. And only you know that, right? Only you know what's the final straw for you when it comes to doing this. You know, I have lots of friends who have succeeded in this business while being married and having families. I did not feel that I had the space for that. So it is only now that I am established that I am taking time to try to like go on dates and do all those things because I was so, this was everything in my life and I just didn't have time for anything other than keeping a roof over my head, my friends, and this. Like that was it. That was my life. You know, I got to about year nine and I guess year eight, it was year eight. And I did get worried. I did start to think like, what if this is never going to happen? Because I kept getting almost, right? Like, I got a play produced and then nothing came of it. I was in the finals of the Disney Fellowship, but I didn't make the last cut.
Right.
So it was like that almost thing, right? Where you it's so painful. And I, the only other thing I'm great at in the world is making desserts. And so I started a baking business and that was my fallback. And I was working it diligently in what little free time I had while also writing and doing all those things. And I thought, you know, I could do this. I could make a life from this. But what I knew to be true was I was going to write the rest of my life, whether I ever got paid for it or not. There are thousands of pages of material on my old hard drives that no one's ever going to pay me for that I had to write. I mean, I used to, when I couldn't think of a new spec script to write, I wrote fanfic, like pages and pages, like thousands of pages of fanfic, right? All on those hard drives. I did it because I had to write. So I wasn't going to stop writing. And so I was like, okay, you can hang in and keep trying to get someone to pay you for it. But you have this other thing that you know you could do if you had to. And literally, what I always say is the universe was like, oh, she means that. We got to get her off this baking thing because it's taking up too much of her time. So I was at the kitchen all day baking to go to a food show because I was going to start trying to get business to do like wedding favors and things.
Sure.
I came home from the kitchen. And there was an email from the CBS Writers Mentoring Program that I had applied to for what was going to be the last time saying, congratulations, you're a semifinalist. Please call us to schedule your personal interview.
And I got to believe after being, because I look very similar to you. I took so many close calls over the course of when I was starting out. I mean, from the earliest part of my career, when I was meeting some of the biggest movie stars in the world, I wrote a whole book about how I almost made a $20 million movie for the mafia. And I was flown out to LA and I met the biggest movie stars in the world. I'm at the Chateau Marmont. I'm at the Ivy having dinner with like billion-dollar producers. I had all of that happen to me early in my life. I was 25, 26 at the time. So that was the beginning of many close calls. I was almost on Project Greenlight. I was almost on the show On the Lot, the Spielberg show. Mm-hmm. I was almost on the, so there were so many close calls. Oh, the money's about to drop for this movie. Oh, it's almost going to drop. The money's there. Mm-hmm. So there's so many close calls. And at a certain point, you just have to go like, when is this going to happen for me? And then you have to figure out what are you willing to keep doing? And I found my happiness in I was lucky. I was in Post. So Post was my fallback. So I was always in the business. I was always editing. So I always had food on the table and I always had a roof over my head. And my student loans were extremely low. Thank God. I only had like 18 grand or 20 grand or something like that. Can you imagine?
No, that was barely a semester of loans for me.
I went to Full Sail, not USC. I still feel that my time at Full Sail was fun, but fairly worthless. And I'd love to hear if you thought your time at USC was worth the money. I'm sure it was a fantastic education. Was it worth the money? Was it worth the ROI, the return on investment? I have to ask you that question before we continue.
Okay. I would say this. I did not go to film school, contrary to what most people assume. I was an English major as an undergrad, and I did the creative writing program in the English department. And then I did what used to be at USC, and they gave the program to another university. It was called the Master of Professional Writing program. So you did everything, right? You did technical writing, you did poetry, you did playwriting, you did the whole gamut. And why I say it was worth it is that I actually paid my bills with my degrees until I became a TV writer. All the jobs I got after that were jobs I got because of my degree. I wasn't like, oh, I have this fancy film and TV degree, but I'm working in an office typing. It was like, I was an assistant editor at a magazine. I did.
So you were writing. So you were being paid as a writer, but just not the kind of yes. writing that you wanted.
Exactly.
So that's I feel in many ways is almost more frustrating than if you were working as a barista at Starbucks and wanted to write. Because this is my personal, because I, from my experience being an editor, working with directors, helping other filmmakers fulfill their dreams and fixing mistakes that they made in post-production, being so close to it was almost like, it was so angry about that so many times. I became very bitter. Maybe I was a very angry and bitter filmmaker for many, many years. So I can imagine it's like I'm working, I'm writing, but just not doing the kind of work that I want to do. So was that frustrating for you, or did you look at it completely differently?
I looked at it differently. I think mostly because I felt really lucky to be with the people I was with, and they were all really supportive. Like I have been very fortunate to not have a bunch of people in my life who were like, yeah, sure, you're going to make it as a TV writer. Like I was working at the magazine when I became a finalist in the Disney Fellowship, and everybody was like rooting for me and in it. And so I think I just felt like it brought good people into my life. So it felt worthwhile to do. Certainly there were day jobs that I wish I could have quit 5 minutes after I started.
Oh yeah.
But those were mostly the non-writing jobs, honestly. Like it was jobs where, I mean, I tell this story famously that like the last day job I had, my boss yelled at me for caring too much about how I did my job, which is what made me go home and apply to the CBS program for the last time.
So you did
because
a job.
I was like, I mean, I can't do this job. So I hate this job. So I got to do something. So I applied and I got it.
That's fascinating. Now, is there something that you wish someone would have told you at the beginning of your career that you wish, if you could go back and just say, listen, you really need to know this. What is that one thing that you wish someone would have told you at the beginning?
I wish someone would have told me at the beginning that that I could spend more time on my life than I did.
Yeah.
I feel like I felt so because I didn't have contacts and I didn't have anyone supporting me. And it was sort of like, it's all me. And I just was so all in that there's so many things I missed out on that I think would have been fun experiences and would have been great. Now, would I go back now and change them? No, because it might change something about my life now.
The butterfly effect.
Thank you.
Yeah, the butterfly effect, right.
But had someone said to me then and been able to get through to me and said, I know how important this is to you, but you can go to the concert with your friends. You don't have to stay home and write every single day. Like, go it's have
balance.
Fun with your friends.
A little bit of balance. But for us in this business, we have to be obsessive. This is not just a job. It's an obsession. It is a calling. It is that thing that drives us. When you wake up in the morning, is the first thing you think about. When you go to bed at night, is the first thing, the last thing you think about. It is, and I tell people all the time that there's an insanity to what we do. It is an insanity. There is no logical conversation to be said, like, I'm going to go write for television. That's generally not a conversation you have with your parents or with your friend.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
I remember when I told my friends in high school, I'm like, yeah, I'm going to go be a filmmaker. They're like, what? Like, it's not. And that was in the 90s when it really wasn't a thing. Now everybody's a content creator and we all got cameras. And I was an absolute loon. It is not you have to have a sense of insanity to believe that you can even achieve this kind of dream. But that is, do you agree?
Yes, absolutely. Because I mean, look, I had, you know, Black Southern parents. They were like, don't you want to just get a teaching credential though? Like, law school, like just go to school. Like, you don't have to become a lawyer, but just go to school in case you need to become a lawyer. Like, they were classic in that regard. And I remember when I got my job on Ironside, the first thing I did was call my mom and tell her. And she just broke down crying on the phone. Oh. She was like, I'm so proud of you. I'm so proud of you. And I called my big brother and he was like, wow. He was like, I guess you were right. I guess it worked out. Because it took that for everybody to finally exhale. Because, you know, they were always having conversations behind my back about like, how's she ever going to be able to take care of herself? Like, how's she ever going to buy a house? Like, all those things.
My parents didn't know what I did. My father had like little to no understanding of what I did as a director. 20 years in, he's just like, I know that you make money. I know someone pays you. I know you have a roof over your head. You have a family. So you're obviously doing something. So I took him to the set one day and he saw me on a commercial set. He's like, he went back and told the whole family, everyone just listens to him. He just tells everybody what to do and they go around and they do what he says. Because that's what his job is. Because they just couldn't grasp it. And then I told him, oh, I'm going to podcast. He's like, what? He goes, I interview people. What? Like, it's like, I barely grasp what you're doing as a filmmaker. Now you're a podcaster. And the only time it made sense to him is when I interviewed Billy Crystal. And the only time I called him up and I said, hey, I just talked to Billy Crystal. He goes, what? He goes, yeah. And I had Billy Crystal send you a little message and here it is. And Billy was so sweet. And he actually gave him like a shout out to my dad. And my dad was just like the craziest. Alex talks to famous people. So now I'm that guy. I'm a filmmaker.
Now you talk to famous people. Yes. No, when I got Ironside. So Blair Underwood was our lead, who my mother just adored. And is, by the way, one of the loveliest human beings in this business. Yeah. And he was so sweet. Like every time I'd go to set to observe, he'd be like, how long till 109? And I'd like, we had a countdown and my first day, he's like, 109, it's finally here. And that's so sweet. Lovely. And so we took a picture and my mom printed it out and put it in a frame on a table in her house.
Like it was Obama. It was like Obama or the president. And you.
It was next to the Obama
Dalai Lama.
Photo.
Like the Dalai Lama.
It was hilarious. I was just like, wow, mom. I was like, you realize people are going to think that's my boyfriend or something. She was like, that's fine. They can think that. I was like, I don't think Mrs. Underwood will like that. Okay. But to your, you know, to your point, there is that level of like, it takes so much. The cost is so high, right?
Yes.
Because you are constantly creating things that you believe in, that you pour your soul into, that someone else is going to be like, eh. Like it's debilitating in a way emotionally. So you have to be a little bit crazy to want to do it. But then, right, when you get that call of like, you get to come work in this room and you get to go for that first day, which to get back to one of your first questions, it's like you walk in and you're a little bit like waiting for someone to be like, just kidding.
Security. Get Nicole out of here.
But like, you show up and they take you to an office and your name's on it. And you're just like, oh my God, this is real. Also, you're terrified because,
oh my God, I gotta work now.
Everybody's like, how do I prove I deserve to be here? I mean, I feel like that's the right attitude to have. I've certainly encountered people who are like, now they're all gonna see how brilliant I am. And I'm like, you're not gonna do well.
Let's see how this works out for you.
It's really go in and prove that they made the right choice to hire.
It's interesting because you feel like at any moment security is going to come in. It's like, security, please escort Nicole and her Clif Bars out of the building. out of the building. Just get her out of the building. And it, by the way, that imposter syndrome is rampant throughout our industry, from the biggest to the smallest person in the business. And I've had the pleasure of talking to some really, you know, legendary people, and they still are like, oh yeah, I still get nervous. I'm like, but you're this person, you've created this show. Are you, why would you be nervous? Like you, and I felt like saying, I'm like, you made like $20 million a week. What's wrong with you? Like you've made it, you have arrived already. But in their mind, it's a completely different perspective. So it's really always interesting. It's all about perspective a lot of times with these, with creatives. But at the end of the day, a writer, no matter if you want an Oscar, an Emmy, made the best show of the world, when you sit down in front of a blank screen with a blinking cursor, we all go through the same process.
Absolutely. I posted on Twitter about the fact that, you know, I just wrapped another room. So I wrote my 19th episode of television and literally had the same thought every time of like, oh, what if I can't do it this time? And it's like, there's 18 pieces of evidence that you can do it. But that one time, but I just, have you seen the Paul Newman, Joanne Woodward documentary?
Not yet. It's on my list.
It's, I'm dying. It's amazing. And the big takeaway from it is Paul Newman literally suffered from imposter syndrome his entire career. And I was like, if Paul friggin' Newman could never get past imposter syndrome, there's no hope. We all just surrender. It is a permanent condition because Paul Newman.
Paul Newman.
So imposter syndrome, just as it's real. We all have it. It's not going to go away.
Wow. That's crazy. That's, I mean, to a certain extent, I think even Denzel will like walk on set, or Meryl Streep will walk on set, and they might have a little bit of it. But at a certain point, you just like, I've been down this road a few times. I think I'm good. I think I'll figure it out. Maybe there'll be a challenge about what the circumstances are, but they have to have some sort of confidence in the ability to like I can write an episode of television. Like I've done it enough when I was not getting paid and when I was getting paid that I have the skill sets to do so. Like I can walk on a set and go, I could probably direct this scene without a shot list and just roll with it. Because I've been on set a lot enough to feel comfortable in my skill set that I've built. Does it mean that if Meryl Streep walks into the scene that I'm directing, I'm not going to crap my pants? Probably. Because I have had the opportunity to work with like Oscar winners sometimes, and you're just sitting there like, you worked with Tarantino. Like, who am I? Who am I? It's just the mental games we artists play with ourselves.
Oh, I know. My first episode of television, which was on Ironside, Robert Forster guest starred for us.
I worked with Robert. That's who I was talking about.
And I walked up and I was talking to him and I was like, oh, it's so great to have you here, Mr. Forrester. And he was like, you can call me Robert. And I was like, I don't think I can. I'm going to call you Mr. Forrester.
I'm telling you, I directed Robert in a film that I was doing. And my God, it was just the level of professionalism, the gravitas of his weight of just walking in the room was remarkable. And he was so humble. So humble. Was an absolute, as they say, a mensch. He was wonderful, just wonderful to work. And when you work with that level of professionalism, you go, oh, this is what it's supposed to be like.
Yeah.
Not what I've been doing. This is like, oh, this is at that level. Okay. And I'm assuming as a writer too, when you work with certain writers, or if you're in a room with a certain showrunner, you go, oh, this is what it's like to work at this level. Because there's many different rooms, many different shows, many different skill sets within those, between showrunners and how they run a room and so on. But when you get to work with high caliber, even if you're another person in the room with you, another writer, another staff writer, go, oh, that's what, I got to get my game up.
Yeah. No, it is absolutely that. Look, I talk about this in the book, that like every room you're in is an opportunity to learn how to do your job better. And to learn what you never want to do when you're the boss, right? Because every room has some foibles. Like I've never been in a perfect room, but I've been in really good rooms. And I've been like, oh, this is how you get a story break to move faster. Oh, this is how you get clarity for everybody. Oh, this is how you help a writer who needs help without humiliating them. Oh, this is
right.
So you learn all those things, right?
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Watching. Now, when you're in the not so good rooms, that's where you learn how, oh, I never want to treat people like this. Oh, I never want to read 10 pages of a script and throw it out because it's dehumanizing to the entire staff. Like, it's you see those things and you're like, nope, not going to operate that way. I hope, because there are plenty of people who absorb those things and then take them with them and then they run toxic rooms. So the goal is to watch the good people do it.
Well, let me ask you this, since you brought it up, you've been in, I'm assuming, a toxic room or two in your day. How do you as a writer survive that kind of room? Because it is, you know, I've been with, I mean, I've met a few toxic people in this business. I know it's surprising, but, oh, by the way, some egos too. But so I know what it's like to work with toxic people when you don't have power.
Yes.
When you have power, if you're the director or the showrunner or a staff writer who has some gravitas to them, it's different. And you're still dealing with toxic people. You have a little bit more armor. You have a little bit more skill set on how to deal with it. But when you're starting out and you have no power, and you have to deal with toxic people above you, what suggestions do you have for young writers to survive a toxic room, not just for one episode, but for a season?
Right. Absolutely. So one of the first things I'm like, just be honest with yourself that like, oh, this is not a great situation. I think sometimes we, especially I will say writers who come from underrepresented communities historically, tend to like, I can make it better. You're a staff writer. You're not going to make it better. It is the environment that it is, right? So just accept that this is a situation out of your control. Right. And then, you know, one of the big tricks, it depends on if the toxicity is to a point and then the rest of the people in the room are good people just trying to survive too. That's going to be your lifeline, right? Because usually, hopefully, there's someone in that room whose job is to look out for the lower level writers anyway, or who just is that kind of person. And so they're going to like check in on you, make sure you're okay, find a way to say to you, oh, I know this is batshit crazy. If you need to talk about something, you can come to me. It's okay.
Right.
Even if they don't use those exact words, right? If you're in a place where, and thankfully I have never experienced this, but I have heard about these rooms from friends of mine where it's just a constant one-upsmanship, everybody out for themselves,
right,
because the showrunner's sort of pitting everyone.
Hunger Games. Yeah,
It's a little Hunger Games room, right? The best advice I have is, look to the community that you have built as a writer, right? Look to the people who've mentored you or to other writers you know at your level and just go to them. And you don't have to name names. You can just be like, my God, this thing happened in the room today and I don't know how to deal with it, and get advice. You can do it real time. I once was in a situation where somebody was in my office saying a lot of things that made me very uncomfortable because of I was a staff writer. And they were complaining about people above me, and I have no power in this situation, right? And so I literally, because I was already at my computer anyway, typed one of my friends who was an upper level writer and was like, this is happening right now. What do I do? And she was like, you go, really? Wow. Don't agree to anything and find a way to get out of that office when you can. And so I was like, oh, I got to go to the bathroom, and like got up and left the office. And it's like, I wouldn't have thought of that because I was panicking,
right?
But I went to a writer who had been in a situation or knew people who had been in it. And that's how we help each other. We, you know, sort of brainstorm solutions to terrible situations, because sometimes you don't know. Sometimes you literally walk in the door and all you've heard are good things about somebody. And then you get there and you're like, This is not good.
This is not what was advertised. This was definitely not. It's almost kind of like prison yardish, whereas in that you're like out in the yard and you got, I got to find a friend. I got to find a friend or a group of people that I can connect with to protect ourselves from this onslaught. Even if it's quiet and nobody needs to know that we're a team,
yes,
or helping each other, because because if that comes out, then that becomes a whole thing. So these are politics that no one talks about. These are things that generally, other than your book, people generally don't talk about the politics of a room, how to handle toxic environments. And I'm not sure how much different these toxic environments are now versus 5 to 8 years ago, where, you know, people were getting away with murder, literally saying whatever they wanted to say, do whatever they wanted. And because they were the powerhouses, they could get away with it. Where nowadays, I'm not sure, and you're in the rooms now, is it, I'm assuming that toxicity is kind of lessened. It's not accepted as much as it used to be. The crazy showrunner yelling and screaming and throwing things and being abusive to the writers like they show in movies is not as accepted as it used to be, just like it isn't accepted to be a yeller on set anymore. Like, you know, James Cameron's legendary for everyone has a James Cameron story. Everyone's got it. Right. I got 20 of them myself. They're fantastic stories. I love them. I've heard that he's calmed himself with age, but he's still James Cameron.
Right.
And the teeth will come out if you rub them the wrong way. But it's not like it used to be where there was just like, you know, I had friends of mine who worked on Titanic. He would literally just fire departments, because he's like, you know what? You screwed up on the plate. All 20 of you gone. Get me 20 new. Like, that's not as accepted anymore. So what's your advice for that?
I would say I definitely think it is not as accepted anymore. There are still people working in this business who don't treat the people who work for them great. Sure. And I think it's, you know, I talk about in the book, again, it's one of those things, right? I grew up in a military family. I used to work in law enforcement. It takes a lot to shock me in terms of commentary, those kinds of things. So my skin for that kind of stuff might be very thick compared to somebody else. So the way I look at it is my job is not to constantly be on people and be like, can't say that. But if I'm in the room and I see someone say something that doesn't bother me, but clearly makes someone else sort of cringe, my job is to intercede there and just be like, guys, we're going to end up in an HR meeting. Let's move on. Like, try to steer the conversation away. Or to say, like, later, if I'm worried about putting that writer on the spot, go in later and be like, guys, let's not joke about that kind of stuff. Okay, I saw a couple people feel a little uncomfortable. Like, let's not do that. And so as you become a more upper level writer, that's how you can help in those situations in a way that you can't when you're a lower level writer, right? Because you're always afraid you're going to get fired. People are afraid to report because studio HR still works for the studio and people are sure how much they trust it. But you can be the person who can tell that it's causing a problem and try to do it because you have a lower risk. If I, as a co-EP, piss off the showrunner and get fired, I'm still getting paid, right? They got to pay my contract out. The staff writer can't do that. And so you have to be willing to take the hit to help protect those people as you rise up the ladder. When you're a lower level writer, though, what I say is, if you're in an environment that's a little tough, or you're just in a great environment, but you have a tough day, right? Sometimes even really good rooms, like an episode falls apart and the showrunner's pissed that you got to re-break it and all of that. If you're the kind, I'm the room mom. I always have it. I'm a natural born room mom. And because I bake, right? I bring cookies into the room. I do all kinds of stuff. Like, do what is in your nature to try to make that room a better place. If you're the person who loves to organize things, be like, hey, once we survive this shitty re-break, should we all go have happy hour at blah de blah and plan it? Be the person, like, do what you can to keep the morale up. And that's fine to do at a lower level. Nobody's going to be like, you know, who the hell do you think you are? And you're not trying to boss around people who are above you. You're just being a nice person. And if your room is having a really difficult day, especially if it's a good room that's having a bad day, don't be afraid to be the person who says something ridiculous. Like, I've been in a room where the break was just completely stalled. Everybody was starting to snap at each other. And I was like, what if we just drove a truck through the building? And everybody was like, what? And I was like, I mean, I'm just saying, we got to get in the building. Let's drive a truck in it. And it got everybody talking. It let some of the air out of the room and like people could breathe again, you know? So you can find little ways like that to help. But if it's a full toxic situation, and I do hope we have fewer of those rooms now, but it does still happen.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
You just got to get through it. No job is forever. No job is forever.
Right.
So if you don't want to report, if it doesn't feel like the kind of thing that you want to go to studio HR about, then just tell your reps, I'm going to tough it out. I'm going to get through the season and then I need to go.
Right.
I don't want to do this job anymore.
Right. And it's a thing that you just have to look. We all, especially at the beginning, we all have to go through crap. This business, it is, you know, it's called paying your dues. And it's a little bit different than it used to be. I had my first boss that was bipolar and didn't take his meds. And he would yell at me. I was working in a commercial house and I was the vault guy. Mm-hmm. And I would get yelled at. And then the next morning he would walk in and it's the sweetest human being in the world. So it was like literally a bipolar, like, did he take his meds or not today kind of scenario.
Right.
And the verbal abuse that I got was, but what was that to us? Making $20,000 a year. I was in the vault room and I was in Florida where there was not a whole lot of stuff going on in production. So I was like, I got to just tough it out. And that's exactly what you do. Like, I'm going to learn this AVID and I'm going to get out of here.
Right.
And that's what I did. So the second that there's toxicity or things that come at you, which this business is going to throw at you, you've got to kind of sit down, take the hits, as long as it's nothing, you know, too out there, like you were saying, but take the hits and keep moving forward, because take this opportunity for what it is and learn from it. And like you said, learn what to do, what not to do, how to handle people like this, what you should do. It's all learning lessons. It's all learning.
Yeah.
Everything, all the negative stuff that's happened to me in my career, it has built me to who I am today.
Yeah.
And I would not have those experiences.
No, look, you learn from those experiences. Absolutely. And I just tell people, you know, it's, if you are working with someone, and I don't care if they're a producer or a showrunner or whatever, who is creating a work environment in which you don't feel safe, you need to tell someone about that situation.
Yes.
Being angry and not liking the person is different than that sense of I am not safe here.
Correct.
Even if it's just emotionally safe because they pick on you in front of the room, like, that's not okay. And it's especially not okay if you're a woman or a historically underrepresented writer. Like, it's not okay for anybody, but it's especially not okay then. And so if you don't feel like you can go to someone on your show, talk to a friend about it. Talk to another upper level writer. Talk to the guild, do something to protect yourself in the situation. But yeah, I worked for somebody who is not what you would consider a tyrannical showrunner in this business, but who literally treated us all like we worked for them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Had no respect for our private time, our family time, any of that.
Just call you whenever. Yeah.
Whenever. That is debilitating to expect people to work 7 days a week. Yes, we get paid really well. We're also all human beings who have doctor's appointments and, you know, nieces and nephews to spoil and kids to take care of and all those things. And you have to be the kind of person who respects other people's time to be good at this business and to be good as a showrunner. And when you run into someone who doesn't, it'll make you want to punch walls. Was that a job I was going to quit? No. But I was certainly angry the whole time I worked it.
And these are the things, look, the things that you put up with when you're in your 20s or 30s are not the things you put up with in your 40s and 50s. I mean, it's just, I look back at some of the stuff I did, I'll be like, no way I would put up with something like that now. But I'm in a different place. I've been around a little bit longer. And I'm in a much stronger position to be able to. And I also see it coming now. Before, you didn't see them coming. Yeah, you go into that interview with that showrunner now, you're like, yeah, this is not going to be a good match for me. I smell something. There's something in the air. I don't know.
Yeah.
But when you're young, you're just like, I just need an opportunity. I'll take it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Look, I have had, writers who are about to get their first job come to me and say, hey, I've got an offer from this show. I've heard that this person might be a little problematic. What do you think? And I'm like, oh, I will tell you everything I know. But at the end of the day, you need your first credit. You need your first job. And if your first job has to be with one of these toxic human beings, just go in knowing it's not you. They treat everybody like this. Like, that's what that word of mouth thing that we do, right? That's how we look out for each other, is to be like, oh, you're probably going to get fired, but they fire everyone. Don't worry about it. Like, everyone in town knows it. Just go in there. You have your first job. You get your first credit. You get out. And it's a terrible thing to have to say to somebody, but it's real, because our business still functions like that. You need credits to get more credits, right? But I just say, like, let's send people in with their eyes wide open. Let them choose what they're walking into, as opposed to being like, oh no, it's going to be great, when we know it's a nightmare. Like, let's tell them what it's really going to be like and let them make a choice, because then they can already be strategizing how they're going to deal with it when the bad stuff comes up.
And this is why I do what I do. I want to let people know that there's a punch coming. And and most people don't even know that they're in a ring, let alone that there's a punch coming, you know, by a professional fighter. rather than know, like, it's coming, and prepare yourselves. Either learn how to duck and weave, learn how to take it and keep moving forward. But this is the reality of the business. And that's why I do what I do, because not many people tell the truth about them. Everyone loves the sizzle, but no one is really good at that steak.
And it's always right. Even once you become a showrunner, you might have talent that's toxic. And sometimes that piece of talent is the only reason your show is going to get on the air. So you got to manage that toxicity so it doesn't infect everybody. Right. And it's your job as the showrunner to manage it. Don't expect everybody else to deal with the fallout of it. You're the person who agreed to it. So manage it. And I've been in situations where I feel like that isn't managed, and it just makes you want to scream bloody murder, because you're just like, well, I can't do anything about it. If the boss won't say anything about it, they're not going to listen to me. And so, you know, it's all, so much of this business is about personalities and understanding who people are and understanding how you need to be around them. Right. And not to that you shouldn't be your authentic self, but like, recognizing, like, oh, this is not a person I should trust with my secrets, so that you're safe, right?
I
tell people all the time, you know, part of being in the writer's room is so much of being willing to share your experiences, and being willing to tell very personal stories to help build a better show. None of the showrunners who are screamers and yellers and abusive get that out of people. Nobody tells their best stories because they don't feel safe.
You know what? There was, I had the privilege of having Martha Kaufman on the show. And we were talking about Friends. And she's like, do you remember that scene where Joey is getting measured by or Chandler's being measured for a pant by the Italian tailor? And it went too far. He went too far up and he was doing things he shouldn't be doing. He goes, that was real. That was one of the writers in the room told us that story. So they felt comfortable enough in that room to say that story, and it became a classic sitcom scene.
Yes, exactly. And that's the thing, right? Some, like, especially because sometimes we get hired in for our experience. I worked in law enforcement. So my first several jobs, I was there because of my law enforcement experience. If I'm worried about being ridiculed when I share a story about something awful that happened at work, I'm not sharing that story.
Right.
I'm just not. And so, you need to create a space where people feel safe enough to say really hard, honest things for the sake of making your show better. They're doing it for you. So make them feel safe. And there's lots of different ways to do that. Lots of different showrunners have different methodologies. But at the end of the day, it does fall completely on the showrunner's shoulders to make a room where people feel safe.
Now, and I agree with you 110%. Yeah. Now, we talked about this earlier in the show. There's too many producers on television, and there's 1,000 versions of them. And television is not movies, so it's a completely different vibe. Different things mean different things. Can you please explain the hierarchy of the writers and the producers? Because I know some, look, I'm in the business. I talk to people like you all the time, and I still, people ask me, I'm like, I think a co-EP is a writer who's been promoted. The EP is not the showrunner, but is part, it could be a co-showrunner. There's so many rules in regards to this. Can you just explain it a little bit, please?
Sure.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
So in its most basic form, when you get your first writing job, you're a staff writer. At present, staff writers get a guild negotiated minimum salary. They do not get script fees. It's sort of considered like an apprenticeshipy sort of position. There's conversations about changing that. That's how it is right now. So in a perfect world, you do your staff writer year. Let's say on a traditional 22 episode show, because it's hard. It's harder to get promoted right away on the shorter order shows. So do your 22 episodes, you become a story editor the next year. After that, you become an executive story editor. So those, all three of those positions are considered lower level writers. And basically what that means is you come in your first year, you're learning what the job is, you're learning what it's like to be in the room every day, you're getting a feel for how you're how to pitch stories in the room. It's your staff writer years, you're learning, right? Story editor year, you come in, you've written it, you've probably written at least one script or half a script. You've been in the room for a whole season now. So now your confidence is a little bigger. You can pitch faster. You follow the board easier. And hopefully you're looking out for the new staff writer who came in behind you, right? Be that person. Pay it back.
Pay it forward. Yes.
And then, you know, you get to executive story editor. Executive story editor is where the money starts to change in terms of instead of getting paid X amount of dollars per week, you now get paid per episode. And so it changes how long you can be stuck working on a show. And it's all a lot of complications that I sort of talk about in the book.
Okay.
After that, you go to co-producer level. Co-producer is basically mid-level writing. So co-producer and producer. And typically what the difference is now, I know back in the like 70s, there were bigger demarcations of all these jobs. But what it means now is your showrunners just rely on you more, right? If you're a co-producer, you've probably, hopefully been to set to produce an episode. You've done prep meetings for your episodes. So they might be like, even on an episode they're writing and producing, be like, hey, Nicole, can you sit in on those prep meetings for me today? Because I got X, Y, and Z. And you just get thrown into the mix to do that kind of stuff. If they need really quick rewrites on things, they might look to you because the upper level writers are busy on something else and they need two scenes rewritten. And they'll go to the mid-level writers and be like, hey, can you guys take a pass on this? Send it back to me. So you just start to get a little bit more responsibility, a little more assumption that you know what you're doing is really right from the top. And then after that, you move into the upper level writers. So supervising producer, co-executive producer, and executive producer. What that really means is at supervising producer, there's a real good chance you might run the room sometimes because the co-EP or number two is on an important call with the showrunner. And so the supervising takes over and keeps the train running in the room. You might stay on, especially on a streaming show, you may stay on for production when everybody else gets released once you get to that level. That's what I did on Fate the Wink Saga. I stayed on for 3 months and helped with the first block of production. And at co-EP, it's really, you're probably running the room most of the time or some of the time, depending on if there's another co-EP. Someone in that rank, in that co-EP supervising producer in a really well-run room is looking out for the lower level writers, making sure that they know what they're doing, that they have questions, they know who to come to, all of that stuff. And, you know, you probably are staying on for production for the whole run, unless somebody else has already agreed to do it and you're popping out after 20 weeks, which just happened to me on a show. And at EP level, EP level gets tricky because, right, you can get executive producer status without being the showrunner because you just have the career, right, to have earned that title. If you've been, you know, a co-EP for 10 years and you're going to basically be running the room and overseeing posts and doing all that stuff, they give you the executive producer title. You can also be an executive producer because you're the showrunner. And then we have non-writing EPs who are executive producers who do not write but came in as producers when the show was actually being birthed, when it was going through the development process. And you get all level of involvement from non-writing EPs. Some are right there in the mix. Some of them you literally never see. Their name just appears on the screen and they get a check. So it's level of involvement.
I had a friend of mine who, I'm not going to say the show, but it's a very famous show from a very famous showrunner and a writer. And I knew the EPs in question. And they told a different story. But then when I actually talked to some staff writers and some staff producers on that show years later, they're like, we never saw them once. I think we saw them on the first day and they never showed their faces again. And they just collect checks and they own the IP. Right. And that's why they own the IP. So that's why this show was, that's why they own it. So I was like, okay. So I didn't know that was a thing. Oh yeah. But they, that one business decision basically set them up for life. They never have to work a day. They're going to keep getting residuals. They're going to keep making movies. They're going to keep doing things off the IP, the comic books, and amazing, remarkable. Yep. But yes, they never showed their face ever.
Yeah, and the one other thing I'd say, when you're in that upper level territory, that's where you get called on, right? For a staff writer script came in and it's not very strong, and the showrunner doesn't have time to give it back to the staff writer for notes. So you might get called on to do a page one and then give it to the showrunner, that kind of stuff. So you get called on more for, you know, someone was supposed to cover set and something happened and they can't go. Your name's going to come up to go cover set because you're one of those top, you know, two or three writers on the show. So you definitely get more responsibility, more crunch time. Everybody, you know, these are the people I need to help me get through this emergency from the showrunner.
So you, as you go up on the ladder, if you will, you're not just a writer anymore. You are actually a producer. You are actually producing the show, helping produce the show, getting in prep meetings, things like that. So it's not only a title per se. You're actually producing and actually handling things that writers generally don't handle.
Yeah, it is. It is definitely more work, and you know. The trick to it now is one of the things that we're finding, right, with all of these streaming 6 to 10 episode shows, is people are getting promoted title wise because they have the clout to do it and they've done a decent amount of work to get the title bump. But because they're not going to set, you're having people get all the way to co-EP and they've never produced an episode of television.
Right.
So that's when it gets a little bit tricky, and you better be able to bring all that other stuff to it in terms of being able to do a fast rewrite, being able to run the room, all those things. Make sure you're honing those skills, because now you're going to have to learn a new skill, which is going to set and producing an episode of television when everyone's going to assume you know how to do it. And you so.
Right. And because you've actually played both, you played in both kind of rooms. You've played on streaming shows. And you've also played in network television. Yeah. And network television still seems to be the old school, you know, you're going to learn a lot going through 22 episodes of standard television, as opposed to being on a Netflix show or a cable show that maybe only does 8 episodes. And so like you said, it's a completely different mindset. Even though the title might be the same, the experience is not. So you got to prepare yourself.
It is absolutely. And I encourage young writers, like, if you get an opportunity for a broadcast show, even if you only do it for one season, do it, because you will never understand what it's like to be in that process of, like, we got to break this episode, write this episode, prep this episode, shoot this episode. It airs a month later. Like, it's so different than the streaming model. And it, like, it really teaches you how to move quickly, how to make quick decisions, be very decisive, how to handle emergencies. how to, you know, I learned how to read a one sheet because number one on the call sheet had to drop out. And we were like, okay, what are we doing? Like, we got to figure out what the schedule looks like now.
Right.
So it just, it teaches you skills that are very hard to get outside of broadcast right now. And I myself, I went back to broadcast so that I would get experience in post, because even though I had produced episodes of television, post is like the place nobody lets you go.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
And so I was like, I need to go through post on episodes. So I went back to broadcast so I could do post and get a feel for what it was like.
Oh, it's fun. Oh, it's fun.
Look, I love post. I mean, I was a closed captioner for years. So I
thought, Oh, back in the day. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it was like, you know, and it's fascinating to me. And so I was really happy to finally get to be there and like see, there's a reason you have multiple people watch it, right? Because not any one person's going to catch everything. So you get, you know, people who are really all about the music and people who are like, we need more dialogue here. We need more dialogue here. And the people who are like, shorten it. It feels
tighter,
too long.
Tighter,
and that's
tighter,
what makes it all work. You get all those people together and it's not just one person having to catch every mistake.
Right, exactly. And then there's always the like, is that a boom in the shot? Then that's the worst. Go through the entire episode, edit, 1,000 people have seen it. And then QC kicks us back. You're like, yeah, there's a boom in the shot, guys. Can you remove the boom?
Yeah, I know. I was on set one time and I swear the boom dropped below the safety on the monitor. And everybody was like, no, it didn't. And I was like, I mean, we're going to do another take anyway. Can we just mark that it might have? Like, calm down. Like, I'm telling you, I would not have said anything if I didn't feel confident. I saw it drop below the safety.
That was your imagination, Nicole. It's just your imagination. That's not real. It's a phantom. It's a phantom boom mic.
Yeah. Like, that's why we do more than one take, y'all. It's all going to be fine.
So let me ask you, as a writer, and I've gone through this as a writer, but I don't write nearly as much as you do on a daily basis. When you're in a room and you're on a deadline, this is the thing that's fascinating me about a room. It's different than a screenwriter. A screenwriter can take a year. It's time. Even if there's a deadline, you got 12 weeks maybe to turn something around, you know, something, get a draft done or a rewrite done. But when you're in a room, you have a deadline and it's a hard deadline. There's no Mickey Mousing around with that deadline. I have to believe that there's a point in your career that you just sat down. You're like, there's nothing. I'm dry. There's nothing there for me. I can't, my muse is on vacation. I can't get through this. What do you do as a staff writer to power through those moments when you just don't have the thing that you normally tap into as a writer?
So I'm one of those people who doesn't actually believe in that.
Okay.
I think.
But there has to be times when the flow is not as heavy as the other.
Yes, definitely. I mean, there's times when like it's not coming out in that natural state that I, you know, it's the best writing ever. But, you know, and I think part of it is starting in broadcast, right, where the deadlines are not fungible. Like John Wells will tell you, don't ever miss a deadline on one of my shows because it'll be like you only do it once. And so I think the way to do it is, again, I think the saving grace is remember it's a job. So like even if all you can do when you're feeling like, oh, I don't know if I can do it, take the outline or the beat sheet or whatever your show has created, put it in final draft and just start formatting. Just start adding slug lines and being like, okay, this is all description. Oh, I need some lines of dialogue here about this and about this and about this. And it'll be the world's worst first draft, but just doing that will get you a file and it'll get you in your flow. And then I have literally had, you know, where the episode's flowing great, but then I get to a scene where I'm like, what is the scene anyway? I'm like, oh, stupid, garble, you know, like all the crap that has to get spewed out in a procedural or whatever. And I will literally just write like, Nicole has to say something funny about whatever, you know, Alex has to do whatever, and just write that and then keep moving.
That's
and
great.
Come back later and fill it in. Because when you have a hard deadline, you just have to keep moving forward. And you can say when you turn it in, hey, here's the draft. I'm really not sure about that act out at act two. Like, I tried, but like, I'm just not sure it works. That's fine.
No one's expecting. But you have something.
Yes. No one's expecting a staff writer's first draft to be perfect. They just hope it's serviceable. They hope they do not have to page one rewrite. So as a staff writer, please give yourself a break. Nobody's expecting it to be like, oh my God, this is the greatest script I've ever read. No. And as you move up the ranks, you know, different shows have different voices and some are easier to pick up than others. And so have I been on a show where I wondered if I could nail the voice? Sure. But I wrote the script first and then I went back and worked on the voice while with the rest of my time. So it's about budgeting your time, right? If you have 5 days to turn a script around, I highly recommend getting a really bad, vomit draft done in like 2 days. And then spend your time just going back through it, working on it. It's a process and you just have to make yourself do the work. And I think, you know, broadcast was a really great training tool for that because in streaming, definitely the deadlines become more fungible, right? It's like, you have a schedule. We're going to try to stick to it. Oh, wait, we just got 3 episodes blown up. Well, we'll get to your script when we get to it.
Right. It's a whole other world. It's streaming versus network. I mean, network has a time. You got 8 o'clock on Tuesday. Someone's got to show up. In streaming, you're like, we'll wait another half a year for Stranger Things to come out.
Yes, exactly.
You know? Now, how do you deal with notes when you get it? Because as writers, you're going to get notes. And screenwriting is a screenwriter for features is one way of studio notes. But as a you're getting feedback like in the room sometimes studio notes or executive notes. How do you deal with these notes?
So until it's your show, what I would say is just remember, like, it's all about what the showrunner wants. Right. So the studio might send you 2 pages of and it'll be very overwhelming. And then the showrunner's going to look through that and going to be like, okay, try to address this one. Ignore this. This is a good note. Try that. Like, they're going to help you sift through it, right? But very few showrunners are just going to be like, here's the notes. Go with God. Like, see what happens. Because they're trying to protect their vision from the studio or the network as well, who right. are not trying to give you bad notes, but sometimes give you bad notes.
No.
And I think, you know, I was brought up by showrunners who were like, at least consider it, right? When you read it legitimately, like, is there something here?
Right.
Sometimes you're just like, can you guys read? It literally says it on the page, the thing that you're asking for, and you want to scream bloody murder. But sometimes they're really confused about something and just looking at it and changing 3 words gives them what they wanted. Makes clarity and they feel heard. So as you're coming up the ladder, you know, on staff, you'll have guidance on how to handle those notes. When your showrunner's giving you notes, just remember it's their show.
You're there to service them.
You're there to service them. And you might hate the note. It doesn't matter. It's not your show. Go do the note. And it, when you see things like, I had a showrunner who I love, by the way, who rewrote every joke I ever put into a script. And I was like, annoyed by it, but also what I would say was like, well, at least I was right. There was supposed to be a joke there. And like, just take your win, right? You were right that it needed a joke. The showrunner just wanted to tell a joke they thought was funny and, you know, instead of yours. So you just have to roll with that kind of stuff because almost everybody on staff gets rewritten.
Sure.
I mean, I've been on shows where co-EPs get rewritten. Like, it just happens. So you just got to roll with it. When it's your project, when you're doing development and, you know, you're trying to do your own stuff, it becomes sort of a dance, right? Because your producers and the studio, and if you get there, a network will all be giving you notes. And it's tempting to want to say no to all of them, and you can't do that. And it's tempting to want to say yes to all of them to just make your life easier, and you can't do that. And it's really about, now it's your vision. What are you protecting here? And if the note doesn't completely upend something that you really care about, try it. But sometimes you're going to get notes that are like, well, I think it should just be about one person instead of all four of these characters. And that's a different show.
Right.
And you're not, and I've gotten that note and I had to say, I'm not doing that. I'm sorry. If that's the show you want, I am not the right person to write that show. And you have to be sure, because they might say, okay, then we'll go get someone else to write it.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
My experience was I was so passionate about it and I explained it so clearly that they were like, okay, try it. And then they were like, oh my God, it works amazing. But like, I had to get them to that point.
Right, right, right.
So
these are the things that they just don't, unless you're in the room, unless you're, as they say, in the shit, you just don't have the experience until you get
it
there.
True. It's really true. And one thing I really stress to writers coming up, especially because a mentor taught me this, if it's your story area or your outline, if it's going to get you the yes to go write the next thing, take the note. If unless it's that catastrophic note, right? If it's just like, we don't think you need this in the pitch, and you absolutely think you need it in the pitch, but cut it. And then later someone's like going to ask you a question and you're going to be like, it was in that thing I cut, but okay, you already know the answer. So you don't have to stress. But they're all sales documents. They're all trying to get you to, here's money to write your script. So remember that. Like, someone might give you a bad note in outline. And if you can finesse it so that you take their note, but it doesn't ruin anything for you, when you write the script, you can try to write them out of that note. Because now they're going to get the script. They're going to get the story with the characters and all the dialogue and stuff. And you might write the scene in a way that they don't even remember they ever gave you that.
Did you watch The Offer yet?
Not yet. No.
So good.
Yeah.
So good. I love the writing, the directing, the production, the acting. It was all done well. But there's a scene there where Albert, the producer, is trying to negotiate with the mob to let them make The Godfather. And one of their notes is like, it was actually from Frank Sinatra, apparently, who was very against the movie. And he said, I don't want to hear the word mafia in the script. And they're like, how can you make a movie about the mafia without the word mafia in the script? So Albert very coyly just went over to Francis and Mario Puzo, and like on a location side, like, hey guys, how many times is the word mafia in the script? And he's like, once. And he like recites the line. He goes, can you get rid of that? Just get rid of the word. Does it matter? He goes, no, I'm fine. And they just moved on. So what was considered a catastrophic, like, how could you make a movie about the mafia and not say the word mafia? They literally had no, it was all the family business. It was never referred to, generally speaking. So it was interesting. So everyone was happy after that note.
Yep. Yeah, it's exactly that kind of thing. Like sometimes the notes, you're like, what in the world are you talking about?
A truck and through then, the front of the door, what?
Right, and then you have a conversation and someone gave me great advice that when you get a note that literally you're just like, I would like to murder you for giving me this note. Go back to them and say, what is it you're trying to feel? What is it you're trying to feel from this note? And usually, it will get them to talk about it and you can find out what they're actually talking about. Because oftentimes those notes are poorly worded and not actually communicating what the issue is.
Right.
And sometimes what they're looking for is a moment between two characters, but it sounds like they're asking you for some huge drastic rewrite. And then you're like, so you want these two people to talk again? And they're like, yeah. And you're
as opposed to rewrite this entire scene from scratch.
Yeah. And you're like, great, I can do that. I can do that.
You know what? That's so interesting, too, because you're right. Because a lot of times people who are giving notes are not writers, especially executives, financiers, actors. They're not writers. So the notes that they give you, they're doing their best to interpret your language. It's like when I work with a composer and God forbid I try to talk music to them. Like no. I remember my composer, I was working on a movie once, and I was trying to get fancy. We're like, can we get this note here to do this or that? And he's like, no. No.
Yep.
what emotion do you want to hit there? And then I will interpret the emotion that you and the thing that you're trying to hit. And that is how notes should be given. It's like, I feel like they need to talk again because I don't feel that there's a connection with these two characters, as opposed to me writing, you know what? I think the structure of this scene is off because of this, this, and this. And I'm talking a language that I might not know. And we as writers have to take those notes and decipher them.
Yeah.
But that's a great way. What does it mean emotionally? Was that, that's what you said, right?
What are you trying to feel?
That's great. You know, great way to interact. Oh, it's amazing.
And it was incredibly helpful. It literally saved me a huge fight. It was like, I was ready to throw down. I asked that question and the answer was so simple. And I was like, well, I can totally do that. Like, that's fine. Like,
that's I'll easy.
Also do that. And it's like, because you want to be right. TV is a team sport. You want to be a team player and be cooperative. But sometimes you're just like, what are you talking about?
What?
I don't even understand what that means. Sometimes you're just like, what? And so you need to find a way around it to figure out what's really happening.
So I have to ask you this question because I'm a fan of the movie you wrote, The Banker. Mm-hmm. I love The Banker. And Jonathan is a friend of the show. He's a wonderful, wonderful guy. I've known him for a while now. How did you get that movie made? Because it is not an easy pitch, my dear. This is not say Blockbuster by any stretch of the imagination.
Yes. Well, I'm going to say all of the credit for that movie getting made falls to George Nolfi, our director, and Joel Veritel, who was our editor and one of our producers. The backstory on that is that Joel came across that property when he was an executive years and years ago. And once he started working with George, brought it up to George and Anthony Mackey while they were making the Adjustment Bureau. And Anthony and George were both like, yes, we should definitely do this. This sounds amazing. And then it kind of sat there. And then George decided to make a TV show and brilliantly hired me to come work for him on his TV show. And that's how we built our relationship. And towards the end of Allegiance, which was the TV show, he was like, hey, do you have a feature sample? And I was like, that's random, but yes. And I sent him a feature sample and he called me the next week and he told me a story about Bernard and was like, you know, you want to make this movie with me? And I was like, yes, please. I would love to do that. And so that's really how I came into the process. And they really did all the hard work of drumming up financing and doing all those things. Like, they were amazing. And what I will say is, because, you know, we always knew Anthony was involved and Anthony was going to play Bernard. And so we were, you know, it was there. And one day my phone rang and it's George and he was like, guess who we got? And I was like, who'd you get? And he was like, Samuel L. Jackson, who we always wanted, but didn't know if we could get. And I was like, Nick Fury and the Falcon are both going to be in this movie. And he was like, I mean, not as Nick Fury and the Falcon, but yeah.
But yeah, though that would have been a very interesting version of the movie.
It would have been a very different version, right? Very different version. I feel like that there would have been a lot less racism if Nick Fury and the Falcon had been taking on.
First time someone says something and Nick Fury is like, bah, bah, just the end of that.
But it was an amazing experience and I'm so proud of it. And I actually, because of knowing Anthony from that, is how I'm writing. I have already written my next feature, which is another true life story that Anthony is directing.
Nice. Congrats. Yeah. So I was going to ask you, what are you up to next? So what are you up to next? So that's the next thing up.
That is next thing up. Well, we'll see. Because, you know, Anthony has 17 jobs. So.
He's Captain America.
He's got all the jobs. Yes. Because he's got like 3 TV projects and whatever. But I'm like,
they just announced his movie, but that's at least two years ahead. I think it's 2 years down the line. They're going to do the Captain America movie, the new one at least. But
yeah,
he's going to be in the Marvel universe for a few years. Let's just put it
Years. Yes. So, but very excited. It's called Spark, and it's about this young woman named Claudette Colvin. who, as a 15-year-old, refused to give up her seat on a bus in Montgomery 9 months before Rosa Parks. And it's sort of why you don't know her story.
Oh, wow. Nice.
Yeah.
Very, very cool.
So, and we got to work directly with Miss Colvin, which was delightful. She's wonderful.
Oh, that's great.
And sharp as a tack and tells a great story. So
that is awesome. That is awesome. Anthony, my favorite, when I first saw Anthony, was 8 Mile, like everybody else. And
we'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
I mean, what else can be said about that? I mean, he's awesome. Million Dollar Baby. Oh, just loved him. He's such an ass in that movie. It's great. I wanted to punch him in the face. I swear to God, I was so happy when Clint beat the hell out of him. I was like, yes, yes. He was so great in that part. He's a wonderful actor. He's such a wonderful actor.
He's lovely. It was so funny because when we were on set for The Banker, mm-hmm. I was trying not to fangirl too much.
Right.
And so I was like super chill with Anthony. And then Sam showed up and Sam was like, "You're a Marvel fan, aren't you?" And I was like, "Yes, sir." And he was like, "Let it out, girl." And so then my fangirl just exploded and I was like, Read it back in.
Oh my. So he kind of feels, so he as Sam Jackson understands, like, are you Tarantino or you're a Marvel fan? Okay. So you're a Marvel. Okay. Just, let's get it out of the way so we can move on and work together.
Yeah, like literally talk to me about Marvel for 45 minutes. It was amazing. And
I gotta ask you, because people ask me all the time, like, do you fanboy out? And, you know, when you meet people or, you know, I interview people, but when I work with somebody or something like that. And my personal thing is I generally don't fanboy out often. Even once in a blue moon, I'll fan. I mean, look, if Sam Jackson walked in, I'd probably geek out a bit. I'm not going to be honest. I'll probably geek out a bit. But how do you handle those situations when you're working with like Blair Underwood? On the first time you saw him, like, oh my God.
Yeah. Do you know what? I'll tell you honestly, the hardest one I ever had when I was working on The Mysteries of Laura, Stockard Channing guest starred on the 2-part episode that I was covering set for, and like, the amount of like self-talk I had to do of like, this is a professional human being. She's right. Here to do a job. Right. You do not go in there and start screaming Rizzo at her. Like, no, like you have to be a grown up. And she was so wonderful. And like, I finally, like, we had a break and it was getting towards the end of her time shooting. And I was like, you know, Ms. Chant, like, you're wonderful. And I've admired you your whole career. And she was like, aren't you the sweetest thing? And like, I kept it very like sedate and I waited till the end, but like, I couldn't pass up a chance to tell Stockard Channing how amazing she is.
The worst is like, do you ask for the picture?
I usually don't ask for the picture. I took pictures with Anthony and Sam, but mostly for my nephews who are like the biggest Marvel fans on the planet after me. So they needed that. But yeah, I usually don't ask for the picture. I think them and Blair might be the only times I've done it.
Right. And again, if you're doing it, it's like, is there a vibe? Is there an energy with the person? You kind of feel it out. But you're right. You want to act professional. You don't want to just go, oh my God, you're Nick Fury and, you know, you were in Pulp Fiction and you're a legend and you're just like, you know.
But there's times I think, you know, as artists, we all love to know that our work is appreciated. And so I think I met John Secret Young at the Writers Guild. We were both mentoring for the veterans writing program. And like China Beach was a pivotal thing for my family because my father would never talk about Vietnam until that show came out. It was like such a thing. And so I'm so glad I took the time to go over like on a break and just be like, I just really wanted you to know this. And he was like, thank you so much for telling me that, you know, and like, you just want people to know. And one of my greatest regrets is that I always meant to try to get a note to Stephen Bochco to tell him he was the reason I was a TV writer. And like, you know, I just was like, well, I'll have time. And then of course he passed. And so I ran out of time. And so I think if you have a moment to tell someone how important they've been to you, it's fine. You just keep it professional and low key and not, you know,
don't
oh my God, I love Falcon so much.
I think when Quentin was talking to John Travolta the first time he was interviewing him to do Pulp Fiction, because he had just done Reservoir, so he wasn't Quentin yet,
right?
You know, but he was, you know, he was Quentin. John Travolta, years later, is like, I think that first meeting was much more about signing his Welcome Back, Kotter lunchbox than it was anything else. That was really what that meeting was all about. I might get the part, I might not get the part, but it was really about signing that Welcome Back, Kotter lunchbox.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know, if you're in a fan thing, like I met Ming-Na Wen at a fan event, and I was a total dork. And,
oh, well, that's
like,
different. That's different.
You know, it's complete dork. But then I went, a friend took me to the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. like rap party. No. And I was like, oh, I'm going to have to behave here. And they were all just like, who are you? What do you love about the show? Like, so wonderful and so just excited to talk to someone who loved the show. And Henry Simmons was there. And I'm a huge NYPD Blue fan. And so I was like, oh my God, like I've been following you ever since Blue. And he was like, you watch NYPD Blue? And I was like, watch it. I own it. I love it. And he was so impressed that like I knew his work from NYPD Blue.
Oh, yeah.
Again, it's like people just like to know that like stuff they did mattered to someone, you know? So
that's awesome.
You just got to find the right time.
You got to feel the vibe. You got to feel the vibe. Sometimes you're just like, not the time. Not the time, but these are all good problems to have. Let's just put it that way. We're very lucky in that sense.
very lucky.
So I'm going to ask you a couple questions. Ask all my guests. What advice would you have for a screenwriter trying to break into the business today?
I would say, first of all, and it's going to sound really cliched and ridiculous, but just always be writing. Like the amount of times that I've had to counsel young writers or new and emerging writers, I should say, because we're not all young when we break into this business, that they need to write more samples. You know, like one great pilot is not enough. One solid spec is not enough. Like you need to have material, because even if someone reads your script and they love it, it doesn't mean they're going to make that. They're going to be interested in you for something else. And they might be like, oh my God, I think you're amazing. I want to put you up for the show. But it's more of a procedural than this character thing. Do you have something else? So you want to have every arrow in your quiver, right, that you can possibly have. And so think about what's in your portfolio. Do you only write male leads? Write some female leads. Do you only write sci-fi? Can you try one straight sort of drama in case that's the job you can get first before you can go make sci-fi shows? Because that's what I did, right? Like you really have to have the material so that when someone answers your knock on the door, you have everything ready to go.
Fair enough. What did you learn from your biggest failure?
I learned that I am not a person who likes to duck responsibility, and therefore learned that the easiest way for me to solve a problem is just to walk into the boss's office or whatever and be like, hey, I fucked this up. Like, I you know, the worry about someone finding out I did something or whatever, like, I don't have time for it. It's like, it's ridiculous. Like, I'd rather take the heat for making a mistake and being honest about it than let something go and it gets found out later and it's like, who let this happen? Like, I just learned that it's easier for me to own up.
Fair enough. What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life?
The lesson that took me the longest to learn was to live my life. And
yes, very true. Very true.
It really did. And it took my mentors in the writing business to really just sort of be like, every time I talk to you, you're writing. Every time I talk to you, you're working. Like, go have fun. Get out of your house. And it's how I learned how to have balance in my life, that I had people who loved me enough to be like, girl, you're taking the next 3 days off. Go do things. Go like whatever. And, you know, I am a workaholic by nature. It's just how I'm wired. But learning to be like, it's okay to go to happy hour 3 nights in a row because all the writers I know are on hiatus and we have time. So I don't write for 3 nights. Fine. Like, you know, you're on deadline for a script, but your friend's wedding is on Saturday, go to the wedding. Don't drink as much as you normally would and come home in a decent hour so you can get some work done. But go to the wedding. Don't miss your friend's wedding.
Right.
You know, it's really important to just live your life, because that's the stuff that's going to matter to you in the long run.
And three pilots that every writer should read.
Hill Street Blues.
Nice.
Just the greatest show in the history of television, as far as I'm concerned. Wise Guy.
Oh, yeah. I remember Wise Guy. Oh, yeah.
Wise Guy's a brilliant pilot. And I think for my third. I'm going to go probably unusual, but I remember being so struck by this pilot, Masters of Sex.
Oh, yeah. That's
the way that they set the characters up in that is really, really beautiful. And I think it's a good character piece for people to study.
Nicole, it has been a pleasure talking to you. Where can people find your new book, The Writer's Room Survival Guide?
You can pre-order it right now on Amazon if you just plug the title in. And I believe that the order link is pinned to my Twitter thread, which my handle on Twitter is @NicoleCookie, because I started on Twitter for my baking business.
Obviously.
And just stayed for the fangirling and the TV. So,
Nicole, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for writing the book. And hopefully this conversation will help a few writers along the way. So I appreciate you, my dear. Thank you again.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to thank Nicole so much for coming on the show and sharing her knowledge bombs with the tribe today. Thank you so much, Nicole. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/230. And if you haven't already, please head over to screenwritingpodcast.com and subscribe and leave a good review for the show. And because of all of your support, many of the members of the tribe have been reaching out to let us know that we have become the number one screenwriting podcast on Apple, which we are extremely humbled and excited by. Thank you so much for spreading the word. Please continue to spread the word. We want to get this information out to as many writers as possible. Oh, and I also wanted to let you guys know that I will be bumping around at the Austin Film Festival. So if you see me, say hi. Always love to talk to tribe members and help you guys out as much as I can. So thank you again for listening, guys. As always, keep on writing, no matter what. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.